deadliest catch isn't the deadliest catch anymore, and NIOSH has been a big part of that solution.
The Obama administration considers cutting a program that reduces fishing accidents. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, international support pours in for the search for Miss Musher Melanie Gould.
We have members on there from Scotland, all over Canada, Australia, England. There was a lady from Norway last night.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Commercial fishing remains one of the most dangerous occupations in the country, so safety experts are crying foul over the Obama administration's proposal to cancel a program run by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health that's working to reduce fisheries-related deaths and injuries. KUCB's Jacob Resnick reports.
This year, $1.5 million went towards NIOSH's Alaska Regional Office that studies commercial fishing. Jerry Dugan is the executive director of the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. He credits NIOSH's research in helping the Coast Guard design programs that have reduced deaths from overloaded crab boats. As a fishery, crab is now statistically safer than salmon.
NIOSH has worked with the Coast Guard in the monitoring of the crab pot loading. And the Bering Sea, for example, that has helped reduce the number of deaths from crab fishermen. The deadliest catch isn't the deadliest catch anymore. And NIOSH has been a big part of that solution.
His sentiment is echoed by Ken Lawrenson, the Coast Guard's Commercial Fishing Safety Coordinator for Alaska.
We use their statistics and analysis weekly to help us determine those fisheries and fishing behaviors that pose the highest risk to commercial fishermen in Alaska.
He notes that while the Coast Guard is responsible for vessel safety, NIOSH's research is methodical in ways his office isn't equipped to be.
I don't think that the Coast Guard can boast a lot of highly educated statistical epidemiologists on staff, and so they have a more scientifically supportable, established regimen for analyzing their data than we do.
One of those epidemiologists is Jennifer Lincoln. Her recent research has been in developing emergency shutoff switches on decks to decrease fatalities from crew being caught in fishing gear. She says if the funding is cut, the industry stands to lose the expertise provided by her office since 1992.
What the fishing industry would lose is a knowledgeable staff of scientists and engineers who understands the importance of working with the fishing industry to identify hazards and develop solutions. The industry would lose fishery-specific information about hazards that are associated with, say, purse seining or crab fishing or something like that. We've also worked with industry to try to develop affordable engineering solutions to deck hazards and vessel stability. So those types of things would go away, the testing of stability monitors on vessels. So that would be eliminated.
Funding is scheduled to go before House committees next month. Nothing has been scheduled in the U.S. Senate, but Democratic Senator Mark Begich released a statement today crediting NIOSH with saving lives in the fishing industry. He notes that this will be a difficult budget year, but pledged to make restoring NIOSH's funding high on his list of priorities. In Unalaska, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The search for a missing Talkeetna woman intensified today. Alaska State Troopers ramped up their resources and are searching an area about 18 miles east of Talkeetna to look for any sign of Melanie Gould. Meanwhile, a Facebook site dedicated to Gould's disappearance now has thousands of followers and has turned into a clearinghouse of information. KTNA's Sue Dio has more.
On Saturday, a little after noon, the search helicopter found Gould's abandoned truck about 18 miles from Cantwell. Since that time, the search has ramped up and given the troopers an area on which to focus. On Sunday, 14 wilderness search and rescue personnel and two canine units searched all day for a sign of Gould. Megan Peters, trooper spokesperson, reported that the latest involves 20 searchers as well as two canine units. and says there is still no clue.
We don't have any kind of indication of where she is at this point other than her vehicle was turned up. And so we're using that to base our search effort off of. But it's a large area, and there's 360 degrees around the truck that she could have started off to. And until we find a sign of her, we really don't know if we're even in the right area.
Cell phone coverage in the area is almost non-existent, and she says it's hard to get updates on a regular basis. Gould's truck has been transported back to Talkeetna, and rescue volunteers continue the search. Talkeetna residents searched the Talkeetna area by foot, car, airplane, and helicopter Friday and Saturday. Internet technology is playing a part in the search and shows the power of Facebook. On Friday, when the local search for Gould started, three Talkeetna residents started a Facebook page to help residents keep track of who had searched and where. What happened next was somewhat shocking. Amanda Randles is one of the two Amandas, as they are known by now.
We have members on there from Scotland, all over Canada, Australia, England. There was a lady from Norway last night. The mass majority of our membership are Alaskans. But a lot of these other people who are connecting in are like big-time Dog Mushing fans, big-time Melanie fans.
By Monday afternoon, there were almost 2,000 fans. The other Amanda is a former junior Iditarod racer and grew up off the road and the grid.
I mean, I know our main focus is just trying to get the facts out there because a lot of people, you know, oh, maybe this happened or this happened. And we're just putting out like, this is what we know has happened. These are the facts of what we know.
She has been able to take off work to manage the Facebook page. When asked what kind of hours they both put into the site, they indicated they never stop.
We are here at the fire hall usually from 9 a.m. to at least 10 or 11 at night. Like, and then we check it. Because we could really do it anywhere, but this is kind of an easy central point. I mean, I get phone calls 6 o'clock in the morning, even earlier sometimes, up till like midnight or midnight or later.
Randall says troopers are doing all they can, and the Talkeetna trooper updates them when he has a chance.
You know, we don't have an official anything, but we're all working on the same side. And they know that, and they're doing their best to communicate with us. One of the things that's been tough is people keep saying, why are there no updates? Well, where the troopers are, there's no cell phone coverage. And in reality, they have way bigger priorities than checking in with us every half hour.
Friends are taking care of Gould's dogs and cabin. Facebook is taking care of people concerned for the dogs and Gould. And residents remain hopeful that positive clues will be found soon. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
After an 18-foot boat sank on Tustamina Lake, two people died Friday night while trying to swim ashore. But three teenage girls survived the high winds and cold water. They made their way to a public-use cabin to recover before being found by an air search. KDLL's Ben Stanton has the story.
The group was two sisters, 13-year-old Hannah and 15-year-old Miranda Udelhoven, their father, 47-year-old Ashley Udelhoven of Soldotna, and their two friends, 16-year-old Katarina Anderson of Kenai and 12-year-old Athena Robinson of Sterling. The group apparently had rented and were headed to a remote cabin across the lake at Pipe Creek. They started from the Kasiloff River opening, and wind was calm when they left Friday night, but Alaska State Trooper spokesperson Beth Ibsen says conditions changed.
Things got really rough, and the waves were reported to be about 9 feet high, came crashing in and swamped the boat, and it sank.
Reports show that everyone was wearing their life jackets. They decided to try to swim the remainder of the way. They had 2 miles to go. Katarina's life jacket was too big, and she was having trouble swimming. Ibsen says the Udelhoven's father, Ashley, attempted to drag her along with the rescue stroke. He was able to do that for about half an hour.
The girls noticed that he started getting loopy and started talking nonsense, which is kind of a big indicator that hypothermia is setting in. And eventually he just kind of went unresponsive, and that's when they noticed that Katarina was also unresponsive.
The three remaining girls made it to shore by about 3 a.m. They then spent about 3.5 hours huddled together to recover from the cold water.
It's very sad. I can't imagine what those girls were going through. Luckily, you know, the 15-year-old Miranda, she had, you know, a clear head, and she kept the other two going. And after leaving their father behind, that can't be easy.
Ibsen says Miranda was able to think clearly enough to find a nearby public-use cabin called Nurse's Cabin, where they were able to eat and later flag down an airplane that was searching for them. A call to state troopers initially came in when another boater spotted debris in the water on Saturday. It included a cooler with Udelhoven's phone number on it. U.S. Fish and Wildlife law enforcement were contacted. Chris Johnson is a supervisory law enforcement officer at Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. He says conditions can quickly change on Tustamina Lake.
You get those winds coming off the lake, off the glaciers onto the lake, can cause the waves to build. When you're coming off the Kasiloff River, it's kind of protected is when you first get in the lake by Caribou Island, and once you come around Caribou Island, you tend to get the big waves coming that are building up all along the length of the lake.
Johnson says the cabin the girls found was a good shelter, but there's very little in it.
It's a remote cabin, just has a wood stove and bunks in it. No emergency equipment or anything in it, just a cabin that can be rented.
The girls were brought to the hospital for minor injuries. Johnson says the story is remarkable.
Yeah, the survival is amazing that the girls were able to survive and their will to live, I think, got them through.
And Ibsen says that the use of life jackets was crucial to their survival. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bristol Bay residents give EPA administrators their take on the Pebble Mine proposal.
There's truth in that we need economic development in this region, but we want to do it in a sustainable way.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Federal wildlife officials are investigating the deaths of five marine mammals found near Skagway, including one found with a bullet in its head. Since January, biologists have recovered the carcasses of two stellar sea lions and three harbor seals. One sea lion appeared to have died from illness, but the four other animals showed signs of head trauma. The bullet was recovered from a harbor seal. It's possible that subsistence hunters killed the animals legally, but lost them before they could be recovered, or they could have been illegal killings. Officials managing the response to the big wildfire north of Fairbanks have some aggressive action planned. The management team is trying to stop the 12,000-acre Hastings fire from moving any closer to subdivisions on its northeast side. Fire Information Officer Pete Buist says a substantial burnout may be conducted where the fire jumped containment lines on Sunday.
If we can get that burned out when the conditions are right and the east wind that's expected will really help us with that burnout. And that should go a long ways towards slowing that fire or possibly stopping its advance to the east towards the Elliott Highway, several subdivisions in there and the pipeline.
Buist says firefighters have helped prepare northeast side subdivisions in the event things don't go well and the fire advances east.
The people who did defensible space work in the subdivisions before we got there and started our structure protection planning, we'll probably be just fine. If people had not done any defensible space work before we got there, hopefully what we're able to do in a hurry will suffice if the fire burns into them.
Crews have already completed structure protection and secured a line on the southern part of the Hastings fire along the Chattanooga River, where there are also homes and cabins. Buist says unless there's a strong north wind, things are in good shape on that part of the fire. He says there are not many structures to the fire's northwest. Senior EPA officials were in Dillingham last Friday to give an update on the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. The public meeting is an early stage in the agency's assessment of the watershed and the potential impact of large-scale development on water quality and regional fisheries. KDLG's Malati Kay has more.
In 2010, nine tribal governments and other interests petitioned the EPA to take action to protect the Bristol Bay watershed from the adverse impacts of potential large-scale hard rock mining projects like Pebble Mine. Two other tribal governments asked the agency to wait till a discharge permit was issued for the mine. This February, the EPA announced it would conduct a year-long scientific assessment before determining whether to initiate a 404C process. At the meeting in Dillingham, EPA Western Region Administrator Dennis McLaren said the agency's assessment would most likely consist of a comprehensive scientific literature review focused on the Nooshiegak and Quijack River drainages.
What we're doing first is a review of all the studies that are available that are out there. We're also going to be looking at the information that Pebble has done in its its assessments, environmental assessments, and then we'll be looking at whether there are gaps in that and then determine if we need to do any more work to fill those gaps.
He said the agency hopes to have compiled all their research and have a draft assessment ready for public comment this fall or winter. Last week's meeting at the Dillingham Elementary School was the last stop in a week's worth of meetings that the agency's regional administrator, top policy advisor, and Wetlands and Water Division director have been doing in Bristol Bay. They visited communities on the Nooshiegak River and the Lake and Peninsula communities of Cockanock and New Halen. Though the meetings were not officially a public hearing for the assessment, regional residents and fishermen gave passionate statements against the possible permitting and construction of the mine. 25-year-old Alana Hurley of Clark's Point cautioned EPA officials against the pro-Pebble mine argument that mining would bring jobs to young people in a region that had little.
There's truth in that we need economic development in this region, but we want to do it in a sustainable way, in a way that isn't going to threaten and devastate our history, who we are, and the future for our children. We want to move this region forward in a way that respects Bristol Bay and what it stands for.
Ralph Anderson is the CEO of the Bristol Bay Native Association. He closed public statements by calling for the EPA officials to imagine the Bristol Bay residents' position.
As on the next clear night in Washington, D.C., or in Seattle, or wherever you're from, there's a full moon. Take a look at the full moon and look at one of the craters. And look at how pockmarked the moon looks. Look at one of the craters and imagine it to be the Pebble Mine, because that's how big it's going to be.
Under Section 404C of the Clean Water Act, the EPA has veto power over any Army Corps of Engineers or state-permitted use of a disposal site for dredged or fill material. But the agency has only issued 13 final vetoes since the act was made law in 1972, and the Army Corps of Engineers issues an average of 80,000 permits per year. Reporting in Dillingham, this is Melody Kay.
The Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly is looking at a bid to disband the borough's ethics board, and a vote on the issue could come as early as tomorrow night. Some residents are concerned that the move could mean major changes to the borough's ethics code will be taken out of public view. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Jim Sykes is a former chair of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Ethics Board and a borough political watchdog. He's concerned about the proposed amendment of some sections of the borough's ethics code. Sykes says the move to change the borough's ethics code piecemeal now is counterproductive, since a total revision is slated for August.
Really, it doesn't make any sense to change the ethics law when the really big rewrite of the ethics code is scheduled to be done in August. I mean, the assembly has had the ethics code rewrite since February, but they scheduled consideration of it for August, and then suddenly, in the middle of May, this proposal comes up as if there's some sort of emergency, and there isn't.
The assembly has set a public hearing for Tuesday night on Ordinance 11060 at its regular meeting. One proposal would eliminate the borough ethics board and reassign all ethics cases to an administrative hearing officer.
I believe the ethics board brought the best of all possible worlds, and they made sure that people's rights would be protected by having a full board, five different sets of eyes on the same case at every stage, rather than allowing one person to receive the complaint, investigate it, prepare to prosecute it, hear the case, and be the judge, jury, and possibly even executioner.
A second proposal would allow borough assembly members to gain personal financial interests by as much as $5,000 without coming under conflict of interest scrutiny. Current law restricts officials to $50. Introduction of the ordinance has not been assigned to any specific assembly member. Borough attorney Nick Spiropoulos says he authored the language of the ordinance after he'd been asked to clarify some aspects of the Borough Ethics Code. Spiropoulos says the revision of the Board of Ethics comes after budget discussions regarding attorney's fees requested by the Board of Ethics. Two past cases incurred fees totaling $100,000. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
A fuel barge is on its way to Cake today, where residents dealt with a gasoline shortage over the weekend. Cake Tribal Corporation President Vicki Wolf confirms there was a shortage and that residents were limited to 5 gallons per person. Cake Tribal runs the fuel operation in Cake. A fuel barge is scheduled to arrive Tuesday, with another regular shipment on Thursday. Wolf said more information will be available after a Tuesday meeting of the corporation's fuel committee. Roughly 600 people live in Cake, which is on the northwest side of Kuprinoff Island. Tribal leaders from across the state will be convening in Anchorage this week to sign an historic accord. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Sophie Ivan has more.
Alaska Native tribal leaders, along with the for-profit and non-profit corporate heads, have passed a resolution calling on the United States Congress to correct a number of weaknesses they've identified as damaging to Alaska Natives, specifically to repeal and amend sections of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which was enacted 40 years ago. The tribes met 7 times before pinpointing where tribal authority can be strengthened in order to properly care for its members. Mike Williams Sr., who's been chairing these gatherings, says they have received 30 tribal resolutions showing their support.
To go to Congress and to the administration to begin to seek remedies for these inconsistencies.
William Sr. says tribes have no real jurisdiction to exert governmental authority over its members, and that they are looking to the Wisconsin Menominee Indian Nation's successful efforts at reclaiming land and jurisdiction.
The policy that our lands will never be sold and are in trust.
Williams says the lower 48 tribes have established consultation practices with the federal government and its various agencies, but that the Alaska tribes still have to formalize the mandated government-to-government talks.
You know, there's village corporations, there's regional corporation nonprofits, and I think that issue, we need to clarify who talks to the federal government or the federal government talking to the tribal governments, and it has to be very clear.
William Sr. says it's the tribe's responsibility to protect and enhance tribal powers and to make sure each of the 229 Alaska Native governments are respected. The resolution pledges to work in good faith with all tribal governments, corporations, and organizations to pursue the ANCSA amendments. The Alaska Native leaders will be at the Millennium Hotel Wednesday in Anchorage. I'm Sophie Van.
The 2011 Emerging Leaders Dialogue wrapped up in Kotzebue yesterday. Sponsored by the Institute of the North, the leadership program is designed to empower young leaders and build relationships across the state. From member station KOTZ, Susan Bucknell reports.
Niels Andreasen coordinates the leadership program for the Institute of the North.
This is our 4th dialogue, and it's been in Girdwood, Chena Hot Springs, Sitka, and now to Kotzebue. And there's a growing network of young leaders who know each other and are excited about what everybody else is doing. And I think the dialogues had an influence on that.
But Andreasen says the term emerging leaders is a little problematic.
I mean, there's all kinds of considerations that go into being a leader, and people don't always think of themselves as being leaders. Really, when we talk about emerging leaders, it's young Alaskans. And by young, we mean 18 to 35, 21 to 40, something like that, who recognize that they have some commitment to their community and state.
Honestly, in the beginning, when I heard Emerging Leaders Dialogue, I was, well, maybe this isn't my cup of tea.
That's Greta Shirk, who first attended the Emerging Leaders Dialogue last year in Sitka. Shirk is originally from the village of Kayana.
But in the end, I was so glad that I attended and so glad that I'm going to be attending again this year.
Liz Moore of Kotzebue also attended the dialogue in Sitka. She said it was a great way to connect with others around the state, but she and Shirk both noticed that a number of people at the dialogue said they'd never really experienced rural communities in Alaska. So skip ahead 1 year to the 70-some people who made it into Kotzebue on the morning jet through the fog last Thursday.
People from Ketchikan to Barrow, literally. There's urban, there's rural, there's native, there's non-native.
That's State Representative Reggie Jewell of Kotzebue describing some of the participants. He could have added people in education, social services, and the arts, people who work in resource development and for conservation groups, people from state government, tribal organizations, and native corporations, recent arrivals, and many who've lived in Alaska all their lives. The one commonality was their status as emerging leaders.
Really what we want to grow is a statewide network of Alaskans who do have a sense that they are leaders, that they can contribute and build and empower, and together shape the state's future, their community's future, and support and strengthen one another.
Alex Post is a participant who got tapped to play an additional role in the discussions.
I'm a roving facilitator, so I've been going around just making sure that people understand the open space principles that we're using.
Post and her husband Lee Post both attended the 2010 dialogue in Sitka.
Yes, and I was really excited to get to come to Kotzebue because I've wanted to come out this way for a while and there's not many chances you get an opportunity to do that. I'm originally from Northern Ireland and I live in Anchorage.
On Friday, the group was invited to tour Red Dog Mine and the village of Noatak. They were impressed with the $8.99 gas prices in Noatak. On Saturday morning, Liz Medicine Crow and Joy Powley of First Nations Institute led a different open space process to discuss issues of racial equity. Though some found it an emotional and not always comfortable topic, participants didn't want to stop talking when scheduled, and they continued their group discussions during lunch. Eventually, a report will document the entire 2011 Emerging Leaders Dialogue, but maybe the real product of the dialogue is what the young leaders have learned and the relationships they've formed.
That was Susan Bucknell reporting from Kotzebue. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacob Resnick in Unalaska, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Melody Kay in Dillingham, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Sophie Ivan in Bethel, and Susan Bucknell in Kotzebue. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.